So you should take some photos. It's really nice.
For those of you who have never been up here before, feel free to look around. It's an extraordinary space.
In the middle of nowhere.
That's true. I've been called on that many times in the last week. Can you all hear?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's an extraordinary privilege to be able to talk in this building. Which stands like a fulcrum in the debates about and the history of modernism in the 20th century. A debate which one might have thought was over, but which the so-called new modernism has brought back, so that the building once again finds itself being thought and rethought for what it said, or seemed to have said, or might have said, and perhaps for what it could say. A few days ago in Easter House, I traced two divergent histories of psychogeography, one deriving from the work of the Situationist Guy Debord in the 50s in Paris, and another deriving from the work of the urban planner Kevin Lynch at MIT in Cambridge. About the same time, actually, in the later 50s, although they actually begin their work, both begin the work that's of real interest today in 1953. These two traditions are very different in character, as I said. One drives from an artistic avant-garde, the Situationists, and develops an understanding of the city and the built environment as a function of desire and as a function of passion, and yet is connected to the Lynchian effort in a variety of ways. One, it was concerned to establish the fact or the reality that passion and desire are not subjective things. They have an objective existence, and they, as such, have to be taken into account in the construction and in the destruction of our environment. These are real things. They're not fleeting fancies that individuals experience and cannot be shared, but they're real. Kevin Lynch was also interested in understanding how people as a group understand their physical environment, and he too wanted to establish this on an objective basis, that is to say, a basis that transcended individual and idiosyncratic readings of the environment, to reach for a reading of the environment that would have some kind of validity across groups. And in the beginning, I don't think Lynch differentiated among groups, but later his work became much more subtle, and he began looking at the way readings of environments varied with class and with ethnicity and with transport mode, education, and other kinds of things. His, of course, is an academic in an engineering school. It was a very different interpretation and understanding of what objectivity and the relationship between humans and the built environment could mean from that of Debord. But another thing they both had in common was an absolute commitment to the idea that the only people who could really validly talk about the environment were the people who really lived in it. In both cases, although one approached it from the perspective of an artist, and God forbid that anyone should characterize Debord as an elite. In fact, I can feel him spinning in his grave as I even connect those two words in the same sentence. But he certainly was an elite. He was a really particular elite. He belonged to an extremely small class, not only of situationists, which were never numerous, but to a people, kind of people dedicated to a kind of pursuit with a fervor and determination that really made him kind of extraordinary. Lynch was, of course, a college-educated academic, a professor at maybe the most prestigious, or one of the most prestigious engineering schools in the world, also a member of some kind of an elite, although Lynch, too, did not like to think about himself in those terms. But despite that, both of these people were really committed to understanding what ordinary citizens walking around in the world made of their world in their very different way. Lynch, De Boer, through his model of the derive and the movement through the city of small groups of people, and Lynch through a series of questionnaires and map drawing exercises and so forth. I also sketched how that latter concern of Lynch's led to the kind of psychogeography that was established at Clark University in the 60s and to which I was an heir, and which became deeply concerned with the kinds of issues that this building evokes in a peculiarly powerful way. One of the things we were really interested in coming out of Lynch was how people find their way around. I don't know how many maps we collected of people's walks from one place to another, of people's movements through shopping malls. I used to go to state fairs and capture people coming out of fun houses and ask them to describe the nature of their experience inside in an attempt to uncover some of the constraints on construal of an environment. Well, this building raises these issues just dramatically. I don't know how you all came into it, but I mean, this is an insanely complicated building. And not only is it insanely complicated, it raises other kinds of psychogeographic issues that arose in the context of programming for psychiatric facilities, which were what kind of things you wanted to avoid, what kind of things you sort of wanted to put into facilities where people who were not in the control of their reading of the environment that we imagine that we have might find desirable or undesirable. Benches, for example, cantilevered off the wall without legs, are not going to be sat on by paranoid people, and so forth. This kind of hallway, which was very common in large mental institutions, causes people who are already sane to go completely nuts. But if you think about trying to program a psychiatric facility, you've got things like this with these windows, identical windows. I've been here before. Will I ever get out? And so forth and so on. These things immediately. All right, so this building is like, no one could have designed this building who had really thought very carefully about how it was going to be used by people in their ordinary, ongoing daily life. Another place this shows up is in the programming involving its original openness. This building was originally open, radically open to the environments. So all the walkways on the lower levels, the interpenetration of the parking and the transport spine, this was all open. And of course, we have powerful weather in Scotland, and the weather made it absolutely impossible for people to use the space. Did you grow up here? And did you have those? Did you know the building before all the walkways were closed?
Yeah.
And it was?
It was pretty miserable in the winter.
Yeah.
If it rained or the wind blew, which it does a lot in Cumbernauld, it was shitty. But the building also, this part of the building on its own, if you stand alone, was a lot less complex. It's when they built phase two across the road that the complexity came in, because they interconnected multiple levels. So you had to know not only the building you were in, but the level you were on, to then work out how you could get to where you wanted to go. And getting lost was customary.
There you go. A native's testimony. Exactly. And these are also the sorts of questions that Lynch-oriented psychogeography was really sort of organized to try and deal with. How could you actually make a building that did two things? One, had the interest that we associate with, let's say, medieval townscapes, or, it's not all rationalized, but you've got these breaks and these turns and these twisted that add, you don't necessarily think you're going to know where you're going, but at the same time allows you to add up into a coherent image that does give you a sense of order and control. So it's this sort of fusion of visual or perceptual, more broadly speaking, perceptual surprise and interest combined with a sort of cognitive structure that gives you security to move around the space very, very comfortably. This is just like the opposite of that. This has got like maximum perceptual underload and maximal cognitive dissonance. You just said it. I mean, exactly. So there's that. There's the failure to take into account the weather. Now, that's not true, because originally there was going to be a break wall built.
along the west that would have kept some of the weather in any event, although not all of it, off of the building. And issues like that, where part of the plan wasn't built, and because that part of the plan wasn't built, other parts of the plan had to be modified, make it really difficult today to look at this building in its current form and try to say what was going on back in the 60s when this building was constructed. Because the sort of ideals, and I think we could go on, by the way, and just detail the ways in which this building violates psychogeographic norms on both sides of the psychogeographic divide pretty consistently, which is not to say that DeBord and Crewe wouldn't have found some really cool spaces in here as well, because there are. And in a way, this is a totally cool space if you want sort of a Solaris spaceship, otherworldly kind of experience.
Do you know what it was originally designed to look like? This space was an ocean liner.
An ocean liner or an aircraft carrier.
Ocean liner was the original intent. My next door neighbor, when I lived in Cumbernauld, was the chief town planner for Cumbernauld. So I've seen the original pictures of this, as you would see it as you drove past on the main road, and the idea was to give Cumbernauld an identity.
Right. And it's also got elements of Italian town villages and so forth and so on, the city on the hill, and its ideals, however, that motivated the construction of this thing were not all that far from removed from those of Lynch and those of DeBord. I think the intentions in all three of these like little nexi of consideration are to make really wonderful spaces where people can live. And then I think what this raises is, what is the problem that this building sort of brings to our attention, given the fact that it comes out of a sort of Garden City mentality to begin with, but a Garden City mentality that had already profited from Garden Cities and the criticism of Garden Cities that said, no, they're too flat, the densities are too low, it's not very urban, they're soulless and monotonous. And so it's a Garden City that's sort of being constructed as a new town center with higher density, and the housing was supposed to be quite dense around here. Again, a promise that wasn't completely and certainly not fulfilled any longer at all. So it was a sort of coming out of the Garden City set of ideals, but profiting from the set of ideals that said, no, that's not urban enough, so you've got that set of ideals brought into it as well, and then a whole set of social welfare ideals that are also operating here that have to do with the fact that Cumbernauld, is that right? Better?
Yeah.
A little better. Is a response to housing problems in Glasgow to begin with. So there are all these sets of wonderful intentions that are somehow floating around. And what would DeBord say about these? Well, DeBord would say bullshit is what he would say. You know, you can't make a great environment out of good intentions. All you're going to get is shit, which in a way is what I think he would think about this building as an example of. The arrogance, in a way, that one man or two men, I mean, Hugh Wilson and his crew, and Bob Corbett, is that who did the actual architect? You know, that they, with the support of a few university faculty experts, would be able to, in fact, create an entire town center. And not only create an entire town center, but create an entire town center in a single building. And not just in a single building, but the one that was vertically zoned to separate functions out, and that at the same time was responding to prevailing ideas, or not, I should hardly say prevailing, but new ideas about megastructures and the new brutalism, and hence the concrete exterior of this building. You take that set of conflicted things, and they're going to roast in a single individual who's going to produce an environment that would be fit for human beings. I think that even at the time, that was a kind of hubris that was already 20 to 30 years out of date. And probably it was never, you know, all that much in fashion even in the beginning. So where does that leave us? I don't know, frankly, with respect to this building and what it has to say, and what it has to say about the kind of ideals that motivate psychogeography in the first place, because those ideals are not all that distinct from the kind of ideals that motivated the construction of this building in the first place, which now wants the psychogeographies, which want now to come and deconstruct this building and reflect on the building and find in the building's
refuge corners, which we're going to descend and hear music in very shortly, spaces of a kind of ambience and frisson, excitement and interest that we can't find in the Antonin Center next door, the completely anodyne but highly popular. All I have to do is just step over there and then step down to the center down here, and that's loaded with front end brand name stuff and happy shoppers right and left, and that's not what you're going to find downstairs at all, and probably never did, and certainly not in the Tesco next door to that, which is, I was in there earlier today, literally thronged. You could barely walk around, it was so jammed with shopping humans. I don't know where psychogeography stands with respect to that shopping mall and where it stands with respect to the Tesco. I'm sure it is more likely to be antagonized by them than it is by this building. And particularly today, when the building at least leaves us with remnants of its idealism, like shipwrecked fragments, that we can come to grips with in some way. Coming up, driving up to the building from this end, and seeing this giant thing stuck out, looks like a candy bar of some kind, stuck out and standing on the slender pillar with these portholes in it. It's like no one has ever seen anything like this before, and no one ever will again. And here it is, a monument that we can sort of revel in and roll around in. And I don't know, I think mostly what this building does and what psychogeography would ask us to do with this building is just to reflect on where we are and where we think we are, and how we respond to our environment and how we can transform that response into some kind of positive action that will make our own lives in any event more interesting or genuine or better or something. Thanks. Where are we going?
Following.
This was supposed to be flats here?
Yes. Yeah. Something about that, yeah. Is that the apartment? You can see one of the signs. See in Dundee. I wonder if they did the Belgate. Because there used to be a centre like this called the Overgate.
Right.
It was kind of half
Bryony.
Contained.
Yeah.
And half open, and it was an old street that turned into a sort of centre very like this.
Yeah.
But then they had the good sense to tear it down in maybe the early 90s, late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And they rebuilt it completely, actually flashy and millennium looking, and not disorienting at all, very easy to find your way around.
Right.
Kind of the rich cousin.